Είστε παρέα με το SBS Ελληνικά.
SBS Radio, Greek Language Program. Θέμη καλώς with you, dear listeners, with the next segment. A compatriot of ours is a leading figure in the sport of paddling, having participated at major tournaments in Australia and worldwide. As an acknowledgement of his accolades, he has been inducted in the Australian Hall of Fame in 2024, and this year he was inducted into the International Hall of Fame. His name is Christopher Chrysanthos Alexandrou, and he is of Greek background, which has earned him the nickname Zeus. More about that a bit later. Christopher is with us today to tour us to the mountain of Olympus of paddling. Christopher Chrysanthe, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We will definitely talk about your paddling career, but I propose that we start from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Where were you born? Where did you grow up? Where did you do your schooling?
So I was born in Australia. My father was born in Egypt. My mother was born in Australia. My mother's family are Cypriot. My father's family are Greeks from Limnos, actually, the island of Limnos. I was born here, very much a Greek-Australian child, as you know, church, music, everything. I studied originally at Waverley College down at Bondi. And then I went and studied law and economics at Sydney University. And then I went and did my my master's at Oxford University in law.
When you say you were born in Australia, you mean Sydney, right?
Sydney, correct, mm-hmm. Sydney, yes.
Can you elaborate a bit more on the family background? What did your father do? What did your mother do, etc.?
So my parents are both, my father has his own accounting practice and my mother works there. We've always been, growing up, I've always been at their practice. So I would go to sleep under my dad's table when he was working at night, for example. Very, very close Greek family, as you could imagine. Both my grandparents, my mother and father's parents, we were very close to them. They would babysit. It's, as I say, a very traditional Greek-Australian family. And then my parents are still working, actually, even though they're well into their 70s. I think it's maybe a Greek thing that you just keep working. You don't retire. You just keep going.
You speak very fondly of your Greek heritage.
Of course.
Has this background, can we say, shaped your early life or the whole life? And if yes, in what manner?
I think definitely yes. I mean, it could drive my interest. I like history, Greek history, even though I've not studied it formally. And I have a particular interest in philosophy, particularly early Greek Stoics, early Greek Stoicism, mm-hmm. Philosophy. I feel like when I go to Greece, I go there every year. We have a house on Limnos. It's my papu's house. And I feel very comfortable when I'm in Limnos. I feel like I'm a bit at home, if that makes sense.
One of the Greeks.
Yeah.
Now, I think traditionally, Christopher, our community, when it comes to sports, is more affiliated with football, also known as soccer. Some play tennis, basketball. I know many kids that go to little athletics. But I don't know many, personally, that do paddling. So how did you end up doing paddling? Were there any paddlers or other athletes in your family? Put it simply, what drew you to this sport?
So it's an interesting story. So when I studied at Oxford University, I rowed because a lot of people row in Oxford. It's a tradition, right? So when I finished my studies, I came back to Australia and I was saying, I'd do a rowing because I knew how to row. And one of my friends, she was a paddler in a dragon boat team. And she said, instead of rowing, why don't you come and dragon boat? Because we're looking for more people. And that was in 99. So 1999, 2000 was my first year. I joined the club, who's called the Sloths, which are they used to be a corporate team. There used to be a lot of lawyers. And then I just started in the Sloths, and it's really just progressed from there. It was a very small sport when I started, and I eventually got onto the board of the state federation, then the national federation, and the sport's grown massively since then. So I just grew it organically.
A few details here. Mm-hmm. You studied law and economics at Sydney University.
Correct. Yeah.
And then you went to Oxford in England.
Mm-hmm.
as a postgraduate.
Correct.
Again, for law, economics?
For law.
So the obvious question is, do you practice law or has paddling absorbed you totally?
I don't think it's absorbed. I try not to only do paddling. I've never practiced law. I like law. But I actually work with mum and dad, so we've done our own businesses, a lot of property, and I think it's maybe it's a very Greek thing that you work with your parents. So, you know, you see more of your parents, you see them every day, and it's good and bad, it's tough, obviously, but I also think you're very lucky. I spent a lot more time with Yam Papu, for example. When my Papu passed away, I moved in with Yaya. We bought the house next to Yaya's house, so right now I live my parents next door. It's very funny. People look at my big fat Greek wedding as a comedy. I look at it as a documentary.
Yes, yes.
So, which is good. It's a good thing to do that, to be part of the family.
It's a big reflection of what the community is.
Of course.
The other detail I want you to explain is rowing, paddling.
Right.
What are the differences between the two?
So it's very simple. And if you say that a dragon boater is a rower, they will always correct you, because rowing is done in a rowboat. You go backwards. Paddling is done in a canoe or a dragon boat. You're going forwards. So you'll see people in a rowboat, they're not looking where they're going. Whereas when you're in a paddling boat, you're looking where you're going. That's a simple explanation.
Good to know. Now, let's focus on paddling, and that's a terminology you like us to use. Mm. Is it a demanding sport with time, finances, etc.?
It is. I mean, there's a lot of different types of paddling. I represent Australia in dragon boating, which is a specific type of paddling, and we can go through what that is. I've also done canoeing. I've raced over in Canada. I did the race called the Yukon River Quest in a double canoe. That was 740 kilometres, so it's a very long race. Dragon boating, as we practice it now, is a very intense sport. So the races are anything from 100 metres up to at the most 5 kilometres, but practically mostly 2 kilometres. So it's very explosive. You're talking about 20 people in a boat with a steerer and a drummer, accelerating the boat to full speed, maybe over 20 kilometres an hour. The boat would weigh about 1.5 tonnes with all the paddlers, maybe even almost 2. And it's got to accelerate to full speed within 5 or 6 seconds and then hit that speed and hold the speed. So you'll watch it, say, at Darling Harbour, that little small bay at Darling Harbour, we will race 6 boats at Darling Harbour full speed. So it's very physically demanding, very explosive.
You were telling me before we entered the studio, in the discussion we had, that dragon boat is something fairly new to the Australian sport, and its origins are from China.
Correct. So originally, dragon boating itself as a cultural practice goes back thousands of years in China. It was a poet called Qu Yuan who committed suicide because he was upset with some of government actions. A very Greek, almost political, you know.
Greek tragedy.
It is a Greek tragedy, exactly. But he was so beloved by the population that the fishermen in their fishing boats raced to try and scare the fish away from his body to preserve his body. And they would hit their paddles, they would hit drums, they would yell, and they would throw food in the water to distract the fish. And from then on, thousands of years, every year on the Harvest Festival, which is in the 5th of May, the races have been recreated in his honour. It came to Australia in the mid-90s, mostly with the Chinese immigrant population in Australia, from Hong Kong, from south of China. And they wanted to recreate it, so people started doing it, groups started doing it, companies started doing it. It's considered a very good team sport because you can have 20 people. SBS, for example, sometimes has 2 teams in a Chinese New Year, the festival race, and that's 40 people from SBS all together racing, 20 on 20. So it's considered very good team building. So it started in Australia in the 90s and really has just grown from there. I joined in 99, so I joined a few years after it started.
Do you remember your first major win or breakthrough moment in paddling? What was the experience like?
So I remembered quite well. We were a very slow team. We called the Sloths when we started. And then eventually we became a very fast team. So the last big race we did was the state titles, and we won the men's division and the mixed division. So So I remember the first time I ever coached a national team was in 2006, and I was a fairly inexperienced coach then. And I took on the job, and I had a team of about 120 people to coach in various boats. And we went over to Macau, and we raced traditional style, which is standing up, which is very tough, 20 people standing up in a boat, which is very uncommon. And I remember we did very well. We got 6 medals, which was the highest at that point. And I thought, okay, this is exciting. You know, the drums, the sound. So racing in Asia was very invigorating, I felt. The food, the smell, the noise, very exciting.
Following on that question, were there any other specific races or competitions that stand out, which are very meaningful for you and for your career?
I think it was in 2007 we had the World Championships in Australia, and it, just being able to represent Australia in Australia was a great thing, you know. And we did extremely well, a very exciting, passionate race. There's other races. I remember a few years ago we were racing, and these are just memories, because in this particular race we were racing neck and neck with the top Chinese team. And you can imagine how exciting that is. The crowd in China, in Australia, we might get thousands of people down at Darling Harbour. In China, you get tens of thousands, 100,000 people watching you. It's massive sport over there.
And just to clear it in my mind, Christopher, you started as a paddler and developed to a coach.
Correct.
So you had accolades in both roles, and as a paddler and as a coach.
Yeah. So I was entered into the Hall of Fame, the National and International Hall of Fame as an athlete, not as a coach. So I'm a steerer, so I steer the boat at the back, as well as a coach. But I've also been an administrator. I've been on the board of the state and national federations. I was on the boards for many years, 13 years.
Multiple so. Roles, in
multiple
other words.
Multiple roles, that's right.
Before I move on, is there any other highlights you would like to share with us?
I think it's a sport where the memories are often about the teams, the people that you're interacting with. The thing with dragon boating, it is a massive people sport. So in my 25-year career, I look back and it's just the friends that I've made in the teams, the battles you have together. I mean, you get on so well that I remember once I was in Hong Kong for the Hong Kong International, and we were in one lane, and on one side of me, I had the old Chinese team. Okay, the other side, the new Chinese team, who didn't like each other. And in that, Hong Kong is a very rough water race, so the water's bouncing. You've got massive boats, and we were flying down. Halfway down the course, my steering oar snapped. So suddenly I've got 1.5 ton of boat, waves coming all sides. I've got China each side, and my steering oar snapped. Now, what that would happen is normally the boat would go sideways and just flip straight away, and then you've got everyone in the water. And I remember I managed to hold the boat steady, bouncing through waves, and we ended up coming third, which was a very good result, just behind the two Chinese teams. But it was also a funny race, that one, because before the start of the race, everyone's waiting, and the anticipation. Waiting, they're announcing the race, and the crowd's ready, getting ready. And I looked over, and the tail of the Chinese team had fallen off and was tied to the boat with a rope. Now, if they took off, that would have slowed them down, and we would have won, right? We would have beaten the team, but it's just not the way. So straight away, I said to the steerer, I was trying to point to him, saying, "Your tail," and I can't speak Cantonese. And I could speak a bit of Mandarin, but I couldn't speak Cantonese. He couldn't speak English. And I had to say to one of my people who speaks Cantonese, I said, "Hey, Alan, can you get up and tell him?" And he got up and told him. And as soon as that, their whole team they went crazy. They started yelling. And so we had to stop and retired on. But it shows the sportsmanship in dragon boating. I mean, winning is nothing unless it's done in the correct sportsmanship.
The true meaning of sports, I guess.
Of course, because we're there just to have fun, right?
Now, you have competed, and you are competing at such high level now for many years, 25
years,
you mentioned.
Yes. Yeah.
What do you think were and still are the keys to your longevity and success?
So keys to longevity in a sport with a lot of people, I think, is patience. I think it's you're dealing with a lot of different personalities. I find I like, as I said, stoic philosophy, and it's extremely important to be able to control your reactions to other people when you're dealing with so many people. So I would highly recommend young people to read some of the early Greek Stoics, Epictetus, for example. These people are very relatable to us. They're dealing with the same things we are. So I think that's a very important thing. I think having a genuine passion for helping people improve, I love it. Even I've seen people within SBS who have started as a corporate paddler come to my club. We've built them up, and now some of them, one of them, for example, was captain of the national team a couple of years ago. Another one has just broken into our top teams in the club. You can see that trajectory. So I think truly loving the other people and really wanting them to see them, have that real passion to see them improve is very important.
Did you ever face any moments where you were considering to give up?
Oh, many times. You are a combination of things. I think it's just the fact when you're in a sport for so long, you get tired. It's a huge amount of effort. You're training every day. The body starts to break down as you get older. As a steerer, it's quite demanding. Your shoulder hurts. Your elbows, everything hurts. Your knees hurt. There are times when you want to spend more time doing other things. I've got a lot of other interests, and you don't want to have to go. With a large number of people, there's always that feeling you've always got to be down there, got to be constantly helping. So there's been times. I think the first time was probably in 2006, so a long time ago, but that I've managed to stay.
Why then?
I was my first time coaching the national team, very demanding. And at the time, I was also on the state and national board, and I was coaching the national team, and it was a fairly inexperienced team, but they were very keen. And that's what saved us. They really put a lot of effort in. So
in moments like that, challenging moments, how did you push through them? How did you overcome them?
I think you've got to focus. You focus on the job at hand, and you try and separate your emotional reaction to a situation from the situation itself. Okay? So if I look at it and say I'm angry at something, okay, the anger is something that's coming from within me. It's not reality. Okay, it's an emotion.
Mm-hmm.
You can control an emotion, okay, in the same way I can control my fingers, I can control an emotion. And you realize that succumbing to emotions sometimes is not the best long-term strategy in life. And I find it's very handy. What a Stoics will often do is challenge themselves. Well, if you want to be challenged by other people, which is what Stoics will often do, the best place is where there are a lot of people. And, of course, dragon boating was perfect for that. And the other thing, remember, it's tough, but it gets better. And all of a sudden, you're at the Asian Championships or at the World Championships, and you have the perfect race. And by the perfect race, I'm not meaning the race where you win or get the result. I'm saying the race where the boat runs beautifully. Everyone gets off the water, whatever the result goes. That was perfect. And I think I've been in the sport long enough to know that if you focus and persevere, you will get to the perfect race eventually.
Christopher, Chrysanthe, the more we talk, the more I realize that I have with me today not just an athlete, but a scholar. But that's a discussion for another time. Now, as you mentioned, you have been inducted into the International Hall of Fame and before that to the Australian Hall of Fame. What does it mean? Those two inductions, what do they mean for you?
I mean, they're an honour indescribable, okay? I mean, we have a lot of great people in the sport, a lot of great athletes and coaches and administrators. So I got told late at night about 2 weeks ago. Someone congratulated me, and she was from the international. I'd missed a call from the president of the International Federation, and I was going to call him back. He's in Italy. And all of a sudden, one of my friends who's on the executive, she just sent me a congratulations. And I couldn't understand. I thought, okay, what have I done now? Okay. And she writes back, because of the Hall of Fame. And I said, what do you mean the Hall of Fame? And then she sent me the press release. And so it's a huge recognition, because it's a recognition by other people of your impact on the sport, but also on their lives. We are a sport it's a very intense sport, but we do have large age divisions, okay? So we have people, children from 12 years old, and the oldest person I've coached is in their 70s, okay? And this is a sport, it's a sport that makes people fit, that brings them community.
Very fit,
very
I would
fit, say. Very fit, very yeah. fit. So they can be a little bit fit or they can take it as far as they want to take it. It brings them community. During COVID, one of the things we realized as a club was that there are people in the club who rely on the club, okay, for their social outlet. And suddenly in COVID, when we couldn't paddle, we can't just abandon these people. So we worked out little training groups that were in the same suburbs, and not very, it wasn't hard, but we were able to then keep people mentally together. So I think getting inducted first to the Australian Hall of Fame as an athlete was a great thing. There are only two people in the Australian Hall of Fame. One of them has passed away, so I'm the only living member of the Hall of Fame.
That's the whole sports hall of fame?
It's the Dragon Boat Hall of Fame. Dragon Boat Hall of
Specifically.
Fame. Specifically for Dragon Boat. It was a recognition of your impact when you may not think you've got that impact, but suddenly other people say, no, maybe you've got more impact than you think. And then the same thing with the International Hall of Fame. I've been competing internationally since 2006, and I've competed. I've got the most number of Australian representation, which is why I've got the right to be in the Australian Hall of Fame. But the International Hall of Fame is another level. That's basically the international side of the sport, saying that you've had an impact on the sport internationally. I've never been on any of the international boards, but I have worked with the boards to reform the sport and improve our governance, etc., our rules. And that was a great, it's an amazing recognition. I feel like I probably don't deserve it, but as someone said, well, you can feel that all you like, but we decided you deserve
exactly,
it, so you
exactly.
deserve it. So.
Now, Christopher, for the football players, the age, when they pick for their careers and they retire, is about 35.
Yeah.
There are some that go to 40, 42. However, as an athlete for paddling, is there an average age that someone can compete, especially in the top level that you are?
So we, in dragon boating, we do have different age divisions. So you can compete in the over 60s at a very high level. At an international level. So at a world championship.
And the body can take it?
The body can, but I've coached athletes of all ages. And as a coach, you realize the focus drastically changes as you age. So the sports, the focus is often on the younger paddlers, which is great. They're young, they're fit, they're exciting. And the focus on them is how to get better and improve. Once you start getting to 40, 45, 50, then the focus has to be on injury management. And my club, for example, has a diverse age range, but we've got a fair few paddlers in the 40 to 50 age group. Now, we're competing often in Australia with paddlers in the 25 age group. I have to use different strategies to coach those different ages.
Now, also, I wanted to ask you this, and correct me if I'm wrong.
No.
For example, if you're weightlifting, I was told this by very famous weightlifters. Oh. They were even smoking because they told me that
in their day. Yeah.
Yeah, but when I asked them, they said yes, but it's not something that we run, and we need to have healthy lungs. Mm. It's more static sort of thing. When we need strength, especially up here. Now, for the paddlers and I guess for the rowers, does the body need to have a symmetry of the muscles?
So
for example, you cannot be, like the tennis player, for example, if they are right hand, you can see the right hand, is very exercised, very strong, and the left hand is very weak, I'll put it this way. Yeah. Now, for the paddlers, and I said for the rowers too, there has to be a symmetry of strength in the body.
So if you don't have symmetry, we have to be aerobically fit as well as anaerobically fit. We have to be able to go long distance, and we've got a sprint. So during the training program, you'll cycle different training approaches, training modalities. The issue when you're unbalanced as a paddler is you're going to pick up injuries.
Okay.
So people are tight on one side, loose on the other. So some people paddle one side and some paddle both sides. In New South Wales, for example, I would normally paddle both sides, even though people might race on their favoured side, but they're able to balance it out with training on their other side. That promotes longevity in the sport, I find. That's just been my experience.
Good to know. Today, and for many years, you are a coach, and I can share with our listeners and possibly our viewers that at least one of my colleagues here at SBS, he's a manager, Davide Schiappapetra, is under your coaching instructions, and the team is doing well,
as he tells me,
having won trophies.
Yeah.
So can I ask, what does a typical training regimen looks like for a top-level paddler and coach like yourself?
So if we were saying an international team, like an Australian team at that higher level, you would be generally paddling in a dragon boat four times a week, and the sessions are about an hour and a half to 2 hours each time. They're very intense. So we'll be moving. We'll be maybe doing 15, 18 kilometers in the dragon boat. You'd be burning well over 1,000 calories, for example. So that's just the dragon boat side. You'd also be doing 1 or 2 days a week on a single craft. So it'd be a small, like an outrigger canoe, and you'd be just training yourself like that. You would do usually 3 to 4 weight sessions, which would vary depending on what part of the training cycle. Mm-hmm. You would do a lot of stretching, and as you get older, your stretching increases because you've got to basically, we call it prehab, you've got to get in advance of an injury to strengthen your muscles and your tendons and lengthen them so you don't get injured. Okay, and as you get older, you do more of that. So you're really talking about maybe 15 sessions a week, 16 sessions a week.
It is demanding.
A full-time job. Remember, athletes in Australia, the dragon boaters aren't paid. As you know from Davide, he's a full-time. He says he's got a full-time job here, I assume. So you've also got other people. I mean, Andy is another one of my paddlers, works at SBS. He's been in the Australian team. Once again, he would do this job as well as doing 15 or 16 training sessions a week.
Well, I have witnessed my colleague Davide since he joined your team, how much more fit he has become and how many pounds
he looks great, lost. Yes.
As we approach the conclusion of our wonderful discussion, if I may say so, we mentioned earlier about your nickname, Zeus. Where did that come from, and do you live up to it outside the water too?
Yeah, so that was a funny story. Yeah. So I remember it was about 2001, 2002, and I was steering a corporate team at the International Regatta Centre out in Penrith. Sorry, I was steering it at the corporate games, and there were commentators, and the commentators thought they were very funny. And they know that I'm Greek. I was friends with theirs. And when I steer, steerers often are quite flamboyant, right? Because we've got to inspire the crew with our voice.
Yes.
And often you'll shave. I used to, shave a mohawk in my head. So I had mohawk dyed colored. And they made this comment. It was one comment. They said and my team won. And as I was going, I was firing along. And they said, he's like Zeus riding a lightning bolt. And I have no idea why, but from that one comment,
it became Zeus.
And there are generations of dragon boaters who don't know my real name. So even internationally, they will call me Zeus. And I just, there's a team from Cyprus, for example, a dragon boat team, and they always ask me about it. They always say, why Zeus? It's always a specific fixation for them.
That's a good point. You mentioned Cyprus.
Mm.
And I ask you also for Greece. Is dragon boating popular in Greece and Cyprus?
So very much in Cyprus. They've got a teams going, and they're coming to the World Championship, and obviously it's great to see them there. I don't think it's as popular in Greece, but I think it's got a lot of potential in Greece. I mean, I say the way that a Greek person may approach dragon boating, the way you approach it in Asia, it's an Asian cultural sport. But of course, the Greeks were also seafaring people. And I say that, you say it's not common in Greece, but I say that, and some of the older listeners may remember this if they were at Macquarie Uni. The Macquarie Uni Greek Society, and back in the 1990s, had a dragon boat team called the Argonauts. It was so long ago, it was before my time. And so some of your listeners may remember the Argonauts as a dragon boat team. So I could definitely see a very strong Greek team with a Greek approach to dragon boating, as you could imagine, right? They're a seafaring country.
Now, earlier you mentioned about other interests that you have in your life. So here is the time to ask you, what are some of your other passions or hobbies?
Oh, I mean, I have a very full life. I like reading, so I collect books. I've got a library at home.
Being being a fan of Stoic philosophy, definitely you love books.
I have a lot of books, exactly. So I have about 6,000 books at home. I've got a garden. There was one of the Stoics said that if a person has a library and a garden, they've got everything they need in life. It was one of the Roman Stoics, and I think that's correct. And so I like reading. I like a lot of martial arts. I've always done a lot of martial arts for 30, 35 years now. I like to train, obviously. I like canoeing, which is a form of paddling. I like that. I like music, but I'm not good at it. I like to play the baglama, the tsadar, the bouzouki, but... I have a go on the lira, you know.
The Pontian lira?
And the Cretan, both the Pontian and the Cretan. The issue is, as I've said, that the standard for musicians in Greece is virtuoso level for the average person. So I always get embarrassed to play. But so I like to travel a lot. Every year I go hiking. I like climbing mountains. So every year I go. I'd like to walk the what's called the Pindos Way, the Peloponnese Way from the far north of Greece all
Pindos,
the way
you mentioned,
it's
yes.
beautiful there. So
done it?
No, I want to do it. And I spoke to, there's a company called Avanasi, I think, who makes maps. And I spoke to the woman, the mother and daughter team in Athens, right? And they're trying to promote it, but they said it's at the moment it's not fully built. But that's fine because you walk from village to village and you talk to people. And so I would like to do that quickly, sooner rather than later before I get too old. It would be beautiful traveling from the very north to the very south.
May I also recommend, since I'm talking to Zeus,
yes.
that you might try to climb your mountain,
I
Olympus,
want to, climb, yes.
to the top, Mythikas.
Yes, I would love to do that.
I'm sure you heard about that.
And I've seen the throne of Zeus. I want to sit on maybe sit on the throne of Zeus.
Is there anything you would like to say and I haven't asked you?
No, I think we've covered well. I think we've covered well. As I've said, SBS has always been a big supporter of dragon boating, actually. The SBS, back when I was on the State Association and I ran the races at Darling Harbour, we would have commentators from SBS. SBS would actually broadcast the races. And SBS has had a 30-year history of supporting dragon boating in New South Wales, which is great.
Well, Christopher, Chrysanthe, many thanks for coming here to SBS and for having this chat, this interview with us.
Thank you.
Θέλετε να ακούσετε περισσότερες ιστορίες σαν και αυτήν? Ακούστε στο Apple Podcast, στο Google Podcast, στο Spotify ή οπουδήποτε ακούτε podcast.